Studios.
You're listening to Skid Row Studios.
You're listening to...
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Registered Ear Offenders. My name is Sal Rodriguez. Right across from me is my co-host, Mr. Chris Z. Say hello.
Hello. Oh, I thought you meant for them to say hello to me.
Well, they're welcome to say hello, too. It's a two-way street here.
Sal, I'm excited. You know what today is? This marks our sixth week anniversary.
Really? Yeah. You know, anniversaries are getting more and more strange. I remember people started doing, it's our six-month anniversary, which is, as a grammarian, it just drives me crazy. An anniversary means annum once per year, but I'll take it. It is our sixth episode anniversary.
I don't think we're going to make it 1 year.
No. Yeah. We might have like a big court battle. We might have a major falling out.
I'm sure by then creative differences will have rent us apart. But, man, I'm so excited to be. I'm just in a good mood, and it's not often I could say that.
I do agree. He is in a good mood, and we'd love for any of you out there to call in and speak to us today at 1-800-893-9562. That's 1-800-893-9562 to call in live and speak to us and ask Chris about why he's feeling so great. Why are you feeling so wonderful? Because it's our sixth show anniversary?
I think because I haven't had my coffee, I'm literally delusional. I'm like a crazy person. I feel no pain. I'm seeing dragons. You know, I'm just...
So for you, not having caffeine is a performance enhancement drug. It's just being natural.
Well, anything, I guess, is there a different, I don't know, what's the opposite of enhancement? Is there?
Dehancement? Lack of enhancement?
Oh, man, I'm just excited, man. We got a great show, and we got a great show next week, and we got a great show the week after that, so I'm just happy to be here, man, and the ratings are getting better every week.
We are getting some great feedback. You know, one of the things that people are saying about us, and for you listeners, we want to thank you, we've been getting a lot of feedback. They've been saying that you and I have a great rapport. You and I have a great dynamic. That's
good
what they're
chemistry,
saying.
Chemistry, yeah.
Yeah. So basically, I've realized you and I should begin dating. That's what we should start doing, I think. Since we have such a great rapport, great chemistry. I don't know. I like watching Netflix. Do you like watching stuff off of Netflix?
I'm a Hulu man myself, but what's that Paula Abdul said? Opposites attract.
That's right. And this is basically every Friday meeting here like this. This is kind of like speed dating. We're doing our own version of like gay speed dating here, 1 hour a week every Friday here in downtown LA.
And the rest of the week we're getting waxed and tanning and working out. So we look our best when we get here, but
well, some of us are trying to work out. I know I've been trying to work out lately. I'll tell you that I've been trying to lose a lot of weight. It's tough, man. But I'm looking forward to the fall because now you can put on more clothing. You know, you can hide it. In the summer, you can't hide it as much.
I've been laying out a lot because I have this kind of cadaverous hue to my skin, you know, and so I decided I'm like I need some color, man. So I've been laying out in my little pool area, but it's weird because you know you can only do so much. You know, I don't want to be the guy in the thong. You know, and then the teenagers.
We don't want you to be the guy in the thong.
And that's happened to me before, by the way.
Where you've been the guy in the thong?
Yeah. Back when I used to live in Encino, they had an apartment complex, and we're out there. You know, it's the middle of the week, the work week, so I think I have the pool to myself. I'm out there in my red Speedo, and sure enough, two teenage girls materialize out of nowhere, and I realize that to them, I'm the European. You know, I'm the guy with the gold chain who looks like leather, you know, and shouldn't be wearing a Speedo, but is, you know, and I almost wanted to walk up and apologize to them. You know, just kind of look, I have a girlfriend here. I'm trying not to nauseate her when we have sex. So I lay out a little, you know, just give me a break.
But Chris is of Ecuadorian background. Is that an Ecuadorian thing? Do they wear Speedos in Ecuador?
No, and they also have nice tans. So nothing about me, you know, my Ecuadorianism belies my exterior.
What does your average Ecuadorian person look like? I mean, you know, for those of us who I'm from Los Angeles, everybody just thinks everybody's Mexican.
Right.
Every person speaking Spanish is Mexican. I mean, if an Ecuadorian came by and spit on me, I wouldn't even know if they were an Ecuadorian. What do they look like?
You know, you probably could. I wouldn't say they're that distinctive from Mexicans, except that typically they're not usually as heavy. that seems to be kind of a more common to the to Mexican, both males and females, is high body mass density. You're the trainer. You tell me what the words are I'm looking for here.
I'm a trainer that happens to have a high body mass index as well.
Triple digit BMI.
Yeah, so let me ask you this, though. So do you think maybe the Mexicans should switch over to the Ecuadorian diet to lose some weight?
That's not a bad idea.
What do Ecuadorians eat?
You know, some of the things are you know, commonplace to just about any, you know, arroz con pollo, you know, rice.
Chicken and rice.
But then again, they have like a lot of plantain-oriented food that maybe you don't find so much in other cultures. You know, they grow the big bananas. They look like big bananas, except they don't quite taste like bananas. And they fry them up sometimes. They either eat them dry with salt, almost like kind of like a like potato chips. Or they can deep fry them sometimes and maybe even put sugar on them. And they do get super sweet when they're in season. Like they'll like literally your eyes will roll back in your head. They can be that sweet. You know?
So you're talking about fried bananas and sugar. How are you guys able to stay slim eating that?
You know what? I've heard this theory. I don't know if there's any science behind this, but a guy from like El Salvador or something once said to me, he said, Mexican people eat tortillas with everything. And he thinks that that's partially responsible for their...
I would have to agree with that because, you know, tortillas, although I'm born here in the United States, it is, I have to have, it's like an emotional attachment to tortillas. I got to have tortillas at least a couple times a week. I got to have a burrito once a week. It's completely psychological, I believe.
Now, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on Mexican food south of the border, but having as someone who worked in a Mexican restaurant for about 2 years, I could tell you that there was not one dish that didn't have cheese on it. I mean, healthy servings of cheese. In some cases, you know, it's a cheese enchilada garnished with cheese.
and Ecuadorians don't have as much cheese in their diet?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so from what I can recollect. And then they have, you know, there's not as much kind of opulence as an American diet either. You know what I mean? Because most people in the third world don't have quite as much time and money to spend on ostentatious food. You know what I mean? So you find them eating more common, you know, things just like, okay, well, it's lamb, it's rice, it's, you know, it's hummus. Hummus is essentially chickpeas ground up, you know?
Yes.
I think here might be the only place where, you know, we refine things 30 times over and we create foods that you can't even tell what they are or where they came from, you know?
But this whole Mexicans being fat thing is sort of a new phenomenon. I mean, when I was growing up, a lot of my Mexican friends and family, I mean, they weren't fat. Nobody was fat. There was like one fat kid in school. It's really sort of a present day phenomenon. And my mother believes it has to do with all the hormones in the food and the processing. She believes it has to do with them not eating naturally. The less natural you eat, the more likelihood you're going to retain weight.
But I also think that if in your culture it's more common to have sex with heavy girls, those heavy girls are not going to feel as bad about themselves as they would in, say, you know, if they were white blonde girls in Orange County, you know, that are kind of expected to not gain weight, you know, from the age of 12 onward. I mean, I remember, you know, a fellow comedian, Mexican chick that I was hanging out with at a party one time, and she came back in. She went on the street and bought this. Have you seen this? It's corn, and it's laden with butter, laden with salt, laden with mayonnaise, and she was just notching on this thing. And I was just like, my God. I mean, I do think there has to be a limit to what people like. You have to go, you know what? I can't eat an all bacon sandwich. You know what I mean? It's just, I'm sure it would taste good, but I have to, like, I want to live long enough to have grandkids. You know what I mean?
Just the thought of a plump Latin lady munching on an ear of corn, just smothered in stuff. Just
smothered with everything.
Turns me on. I am hot.
Well, it's a funny thing because, yeah, you know, like a lot of Mexican girls, they can be heavy, but they still have that real pretty skin, that real pretty hair. And you go, you know what? Fuck my weight criteria.
You know what? I have heard many an Anglo woman, many a waspy woman mention the hair and skin of a Latin woman. That is very true.
Asian girl hair and Mexican girl hair are my two favorites, man, in the world. That kind of, it looks like shiny raven's feathers, you know?
So you must want to date a Filipino woman then, because you get the best of all worlds.
You know me, man. I love Filipinos. Yeah, exactly. I've often said that I like Asian girls and I like black girls, and Filipinos are Asian girls with black girl bodies. So that's...
I am getting so turned on right now. Listen, we got to move along because I'm starting to get aroused. Call us in. Hey, listen, if anybody wants to call in, make sure you get it in early because a couple of times we had like 2 minutes left and we couldn't get to our caller. So make sure if you want to call in, you get in here early. 1-800-893-9562. Chris, what do we have on the show today and who do we got in the studio today?
Well, our guest today is Paul Osborne. He's an acclaimed director. He's a Los Angeles native. He's a writer of the upcoming suspense drama, Favor. Now in post-production for release in 2013. Paul's going to be our guest today. We also got a brand new segment, two of them actually. It's called What Do You Want to Be When You Grow Up? Sal and I kind of reflect on dreams we might have had, ambitions we might have had as a child that maybe didn't quite pan out and why that is the case. We also got Tech Talk. Sal and I are going to toss around some ideas about some existing technology and how it can be improved and kind of wonder why it hasn't been improved upon already. And of course, we've got the staple, Sal's Rant, big fan favorite there. And become a weekly recurring segment. I think the only one that we have done consistently since day one, correct, Sal?
I believe so. That has been a recurring weekly segment due to audience demand.
And I've got a special surprise for you, but I'm not going to spoil the surprise. It comes after Sal's rant.
A surprise? Are you bringing in a Filipina girl who's plump eating an elote?
No, it's just some lumpia. This surprise is as much for you as it is for the guest, so I can't reveal the details to you. That aside, let's go ahead and get started, Sal, with what do you want to be when you grow up?
Well, these are our earliest recollections of once we realized that you can obtain an occupation and get into a career, what was it that you wanted to be? Now, mine, strange as it may seem, was not to be an internet radio host.
What?
That only came about within the last couple of years. I will tell you this. My earliest memories of occupational dreaming? Okay, I'll take it. Wanted to be a stuntman. That's what I wanted to be. When I was a kid, my mother used to take me to Universal Studios and we would see the Wild West stunt show and we see the guys get shot and do flips down and land on the big mat and all that. And I remember saying to my mom, I want to do that. And my mom's one of those moms, if you told my mom, I'm going to run away and join the circus, she'd be like, yeah, go for it. I mean, she encouraged anything theatrical, anything performing related. I'm going to go work on a cruise ship and be out to sea for a year and be performing on stage. She would say, great, go for it. So I told my mom I want to be a stuntman. She was very supportive and encouraging. I used to ride my bicycle down the street and I would intentionally fall off of it. I would fall and then strangers would run over and say, are you okay, little boy? And I would jump up and I would say, stuntman is what I would say. And people would say, wow, you know, in my memory, they were just amazed by how real it looked when I would fall off the bike. I mean, if there would have been a camera there, I would have been on fail blog, but it would have been an intentional fail blog.
It actually sounds more like a Jamie Kennedy's ex, you know, you've been exed. Yeah, you've been stuntman.
That's what it was. It's like I was pranking people at such a young age. So my earliest childhood memory of what I wanted to be when I grew up was a stuntman. And then when I was about 18, they had open call auditions to work as a cowboy stuntman. They had him at Madeline Clark Studios in North Hollywood on Magnolia. Come and audition to be a stuntman at Universal Studios. And I went there. I took a few fake punches. I fell backwards. I think I did fine on the audition. And I think my mother auditioned too to be some sort of purse-wielding hag or something like that, whatever it was. So my mother and I both auditioned to be stunt people at Universal Studios because they said they were taking people with no experience. But even though we both auditioned, the audition went great. We did not get the roles.
Could it be because you look more like an Indian than a cowboy?
I think that's it. It must have been an ethnic thing. I pull the race card. Whenever I don't get something, whenever I'm not successful at something, I pull the race card all the time. I'm not too proud.
I have to say, if I was to comprise a list of about five things that they shouldn't have open auditions for, stuntman would be one. Doctor would be another.
Open auditions for plastic surgeon this coming Wednesday.
Hey, you know how most stuntmen spend about a decade training in gymnastics and martial arts? And now we want open. We want fresh. We want fresh faces in here. We want somebody who doesn't even know how to fall safely.
And the worst part was I didn't get it. I mean, that was my childhood dream. I didn't get it. So then I moved on, and now here I am as a internet radio personality.
But I mean, was it a one-shot deal? That's the only stunt audition you ever went on?
Well, I'm sure that they had them. I could have traveled the nation and auditioned for any Universal Studio. I should have went to Florida, where you're from, and auditioned for Universal Studios Florida.
What about the Jackass movement when that came along and kids were trying to jump over cars and stuff?
I was ahead of the curve in that sense. But let's hear about, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was one of those kids who, although I did have some interest, I never ever selected one specific thing and worked towards it. But when I did graduate high school and I was kind of floundering around, I knew I was going to college, but I had no idea what I wanted to study because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I do remember that I'd always had an interest in animals. You know, I've always been partial to animals, these days more so than human beings. But I went to Ocean World in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It's basically kind of like a Sea World. And, you know, while I was there, I watched the show and I said, you know, that looks like a great career. There's people communing with nature and they're, you know, swimming with the whales and whatnot. So I asked, I said, how does somebody do that? What background is required to train whales, you know? And they said, you know, really not much. They said, most people here, they just have a basic college degree. They have a certification scuba diving. And they said, you know, if you're interested, you're welcome to join our volunteer program. And
So this is the equivalent of an open audition.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I literally stumbled into it. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that, you know. And they said, you know, you start out by feeding the animals and stuff like that and getting acquainted with the whales. And maybe, you know, one day you'll work up to, you know, being the person who stands on the thing's nose.
Which is a dangerous job. I mean, those guys are getting, I think they've getting eaten or flipped around.
Yeah, yeah. They have. They had only a couple years ago when the whale took the lady by the ponytail.
Yes.
Dragged her under.
Yeah, because these are killer whales.
They are. And
hence the word killer. Yeah,
it's called the anthropomorphic fallacy, the idea that one day you can, train hundreds of thousands of years of instinct out of an animal. Oh, no, he really loves me. This pit bull's not a pit bull. I've raised him since birth. He doesn't know. No, you idiot. Watch Grizzly Man.
Right. Yeah,
that's how wrong things can go. But anyway, so it came time for me to do my volunteer work, and I placed a phone call, and the call was not returned. And I placed another call, and I think another call. And I came to read in the newspaper several weeks later that the Ocean World had been abruptly closed down. I think they had either not been caring for the animals the way they were supposed to, or something to that effect. Enough so that they just very abruptly closed down and never reopened. So that dashed my dreams of. Though I did go on to scuba dive. I did scuba dive for a few years, and I did have some fun adventures, but that dream never materialized.
Well, the name Ocean World, it just sounds like it would be a place where the Simpsons would go. We're going to, the family's going to Ocean World. That was my bad Homer Simpson impression, but it just sounds like it's a made-up place, like it doesn't even really exist. Yeah,
and the logo looks just like SeaWorld, except it's Ocean World. Sort of like McDowell's. Remember from Coming to America? McDowell's, they have the Golden Arches.
Oh, we have the Golden Arcs. That's right, yes. I remember that. But then when you went into scuba diving, did you ever do... My oldest siblings have gone scuba diving at night with flashlights. I couldn't think of anything crazier than
night diving. I was terrified, utterly terrified, because you think about how dark it gets at night. Now imagine when you're 100 feet underwater. So in many cases, I would think that I'd lost my party, and I'd start to panic and look around, and there'd be somebody literally 2 feet away from you. But that's how dark it is, that unless you're looking directly at their light source, you don't even know they're there.
That's craziness. That's stuff white people do.
It is definitely white.
And since you are white looking,
yeah, you know, Chris gets to live in the... I straddle both worlds.
He does. Because he's Latino, but he looks very Anglo-Caucasian, so he could walk amongst you, and you would never know.
It's like that movie. You ever see the movie Europa?
Oh, I thought you were going to say They Live with Roddy Piper.
Oh, no.
Or V, right. like he's going to pull off his white people mask and he's got a Latino face underneath there.
You know what stings, Sal? I'm old enough to remember both Vs, both incarnations of V.
Oh, the original V with Robert Englund, and then the new one.
And the remake.
Yeah. Well, I like the original V because you had real latex. Let me tell you something. For those of you who are movie fans, please, latex, latex, latex. They're just going nuts with this CGI. Can we get some friggin' latex in here, please?
Yeah, I'll take bad latex over bad CGI any day, because it's the three-dimensionality of it. It's the texture. When you can see that there's something there, it makes it more real.
Yes, and it is real, because essentially the camera is capturing something right in front of it that is real versus it being added later with a computer that is not, you know, quote-unquote real. I think brings to mind our next topic, which is Tech Talk, where we talk about improvements on modern day technology and why we think they should be better, or how things could or would be better.
Yeah, I was thinking about email a lot. I mean, I've been using email myself for what, about 13 years, and I have yet to see any significant improvements.
Yeah,
I mean, aside from formatting, you know, okay, you can make things bold and you can add smiley face icons.
Yeah.
What has really improved about email?
Well, nothing. I mean, the only thing you have is you can either do your IP address email or a web-based email. And that's about it, right? Those are the only two email choices. And email, speaking of email, they say it's actually going the way of the dinosaur. Most people are texting or going Facebook now. People don't even email anymore. And it's come to the point where I can honestly say that I probably check my phone for texts, and I check Facebook more than I check my email address book.
There's been a measurable cultural shift. There was an incident a couple weeks ago where I called somebody, left them a message, and they responded to me with a text saying, I work better through text. So they actually either listened, or even worse, didn't listen to the message, and then took the time to text me back, not to respond to what I was inquiring about, but just to tell me that they preferred text as a medium of communication. So.
Well, I don't know how Apple's is going to make any headway or leeway with this FaceTime, because the way it seems nowadays, people just don't want to talk, let alone be seen. So people don't want to be in front of their phone and see the person that you're talking to. We don't want to be seen. We don't even want to talk. We just want to send text. So what is the improvement on email that you think would be great?
Well, here's one. I can't believe that they don't come up with kind of... Remember Inspector Gadget's, this message will self-destruct, something like that, an email. Yeah. You send the email, and 30 days later, it dies. So that gives the recipient ample time to read it, reread it, do whatever they need to it. But eventually it goes away so that you don't have to worry about 7 years later when you become a celebrity or whatever the case is. They dredge this out of their old email history bank.
Yeah. Or if I send somebody a new photo of my penis or something.
Right. Yeah, something to that effect, which they're perfectly fine with at the time. But 7 years down the road, when they want to jump on some, you know, some Tiger Woods-like lawsuit, they can't go back and, you know, pull this out and use it as evidence of how you sexually harassed them.
As you can see, Chris is preparing for his future in ways to cover his ass.
I'm a smart guy, Sal.
It's like you should be able to send your dick to somebody today without having it haunt you 7 years from now.
I always say stupid people learn from experience, intelligent people learn from observation. And yes. I watch others fail, and I pledge to never, repeat their failures.
Yes, they say wisdom is learning from the mistakes of others.
Correct.
But so attached to that, I think, would be what I've long called or wanted to call email, quote unquote, with strings attached. And what that is, you know, as soon as you hit that send button, you think, oh, I forgot something, or there's a typo there, but you send it and it's done, it's gone. You should have 60 seconds to pull it back. You should have 60 seconds once you hit send to retrieve it because you made a mistake or because you want to add something or take something away. So I call it email with strings attached, where you can pull it back like almost like a fish on a hook.
You know me well enough to know I don't know diddly about technology.
You send texts and emails and Facebook messages. You know about as much as your average person needs to know.
Right, but I know enough to know this, that that sounds pretty technology intensive. The idea of a computer somehow retrieving and physically removing an email from somebody's private email account, that almost seems...
It almost seems blasphemous.
I don't know if ethical is not the word, but it almost seems like it's kind of maybe even a violation of their privacy if you were to have some kind of technology that could invade their email without their knowledge or consent and retrieve your message. However, what about the option to simply delete it? Like, you know, you realize 4 hours after you sent it that you were mistaken, or you were angered at the time.
That you didn't want to really tell your wife you're cheating on her.
Right. So you perform some function that makes that email just kind of wither and die where it is, but without, you know, you see what I'm saying? That way.
But why would that be any less controversial than just pulling it back with a string? You know, a metaphorical string.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think it's the same thing. In other words, what we are asking of the internet providers, what we are asking of Apple, Google, Bing, whoever the powers that be, is to give us more empowerment as a sender of an email so that we can pull it back. We can limit the time that the other person has it, right? Empower the sender as opposed to having all the power in the hand of the recipient.
Let me add this proviso to what I said before. What if you could actually send emails and instead of just an expiration date, it almost guaranteed that the recipient had to witness the email? Let's say you were, you know, you work in a Fortune 500 company and you're discussing some sensitive R&D technology that hasn't been patented. What if you could send an email and upon opening it, it sets a timer, a countdown clock that it says, okay, well, now the recipient has clearly witnessed this email, but maybe 10 days from now, it's going to disappear. It's going to expire, because that way you don't have to worry about, oh, and it can't be copied. That's what makes this unique. It can't be copied. It can't be printed out. It's almost like a, what do they call it? Like a read-only document where you can't make edits to it. So I send you the email because I'm your employer and I know that you need this information. But now I don't have to worry about you printing this email or sharing it with my competitors. You can only look at it and it's inevitably going to die. But it's only going to die, say, 10 days after... after you've looked at it and the computer knows that you've actually physically opened it.
I'm all in favor of that. So if I'm a boss of a company and I send out pictures of my penises to everybody in the company, it should self-destruct in 10 days and I should not be able to be sued then a month from now, right?
Right. And they can't print it out. They can't forward it. They can't share it in any way. So,
by the way, that's what I imagine I would do if I were a CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
If there's anybody listening who is thinking about making Sal CEO of their Fortune 500 company,
maybe they're going to have an open call for CEOs, right? And you and I can show up. Hey, listen, anybody want to call in at 1-800-893-9562? We're going to go ahead and bring our guest out. All right, we're going to go ahead and bring our guest out.
You bet. We got Paul Osborne, everybody. Paul previously directed the acclaimed documentary Official Rejection about the experiences of filmmakers at film festivals, and he wrote the cult hit crime thriller 10 till noon. He's also been a contributing writer for Movie Makers Magazine and FilmThreat.com. You can follow him at Twitter.com. Paul Makes Movies. Please welcome to the show, Los Angeles native, writer, director, and editor of the upcoming suspense drama, Favor, Paul Osborne. Come on
Paul
in, Paul.
Thomas
take a seat.
Anderson.
Paul Thomas Anderson. Okay, Paul Osborne,
guys,
ladies and gentlemen.
Come see the master.
How's it going, man?
It's going well. Actually, Sal and I met when Official Rejection played L.A. 2 years ago.
I think. L.A. United Film Festival, yeah. Of which I was the host. Yep. And then I had the pleasure of meeting Paul Osborne and some of your compatriots.
Yes, but you didn't send me any self-destructing pictures of your penis, so I'm a little upset.
I did not, but the day is young.
as is your willy, I'm sure.
So tell us about, first of all, I want to get into the history of Official Rejection because it has to start with 10 till noon, right? Isn't that how it started?
It does. 10 till noon, I made that with a friend of mine, Scott Storm, who directed it. I wrote it. And, that film, I think with any indie film, you have these high expectations. The film's going to go somewhere and, go to Sundance and get the big sale and all these things. I think every filmmaker lies to themselves about that. Or at least they believe it because that was true, 20 years ago. What's funny is no one was really talking about the fact that it wasn't really that true anymore, that you really couldn't do that if you were truly an outsider who hadn't made a film from inside the system. So we made 10 till noon, and then we started going on the festival circuit, and we realized it was going to be a very different experience than what we had been led to believe from E! And watching IFC and Sundance Channel. So I thought, we got to go in armed with knowledge, and I thought, well, filmmakers go to film festivals, so someone must have made a movie about this, about what you really go through. And I looked, and no one had done it. No one had made one. I think they were too afraid to sort of...
Because you think, I'm going to piss some people off.
Oh, yeah. Like, I don't want to be excluded from Sundance. Well, guess what? Yeah. Asshole, you already are.
Yeah.
So goddamn be honest about it. So I thought, if I can't find a documentary, I'll make one.
Yes.
And since we're going to fuck up a lot, I'm going to make it a comedy. So that's how Official Rejection was born. And we got a lot of cooperation. I mean, once we started making it, people came out of the woodwork to talk about the process.
I was surprised. I saw the trailer for it, and you had Kevin Smith talking about Clerks.
Yeah, and he freely admitted. He said, I don't think if I make Clerks today, I have any hope of hell getting it.
Yeah, that part moved me. Where he was very candid in his segment.
We have a clip, Nick. Can we go ahead and play the audio clip of the trailer for Official Rejection?
Official Selection, the Cannes Film Festival. Official Selection, the Toronto International Film Festival. Official Selection, the Sundance Film Festival. Or maybe not.
The biggest misconception that filmmakers have about film festivals is they're gonna go there, they're gonna show their movie, someone's gonna buy it, they're gonna have $1 million. And they're gonna have a great career! And it's not that.
I think it's almost impossible for a small independent movie to get into any big festival at this point in time.
Sundance isn't an independent film festival anymore.
The word independent has been stolen by the majors.
Suddenly it was like, you can't be the film from nowhere that just explodes. If we made Clerks today and submitted it to Sundance, I don't think it'd get in. I really don't.
There's a different route to go, and that is to play the small festivals.
We go straight from the airport to the festival, and there's no one there.
They want us to draw a whole bunch of people here, but I'm not willing to put that much work into it.
Started out with the purest intention.
You're broke, and you're stressed, and you still didn't sell your film.
And a few more along the way.
Filmmakers have done some very interesting things to try and get their films programmed.
I've actually received some death threats.
We're quite forthright on our website that we accept bribes. It'd be a lie to say that there wasn't some, sexual favors going on.
Meeting every person at a festival is an opportunity.
There tend to be, at these film festivals, lots of girls, pretty girls.
Hi!
I can't answer this. I really can't. I will get so much trouble.
Now I know.
Would you dye your film dye?
Now I feel like a celebrity.
Don't let any rejection stop you.
Just don't give up. Don't give up.
I'm strong within, so serve me up. Your official rejection.
Not enough of this.
Got to do some more of that. You want to get into the big festivals.
And that, for those of you who haven't seen the trailer, is a man miming sucking a cock.
Yes, yeah.
Lovingly.
It kind of looked like he was eating a pastrami sandwich also, like holding a big submarine.
I think your mind just pictured that to kind of take you out of what he was, the actual visual he was trying to draw. Paul, am I to take it that your movie, the thesis statement, the slug line, if you will, is that the big leagues, the big players have hijacked the only conduit for small time, like the small guy to get into the big leagues. They've hijacked, and basically it's sort of like the way that the big Viacom hijacked Comedy Central that actually used to be dedicated to comedy, or even MTV that used to be dedicated to
music videos, actually.
Right, but not just to showing music videos. The point was they were introducing the world to the wealth of music that was out there, and it's not that now. It's everything but. Yeah. I mean, being a working actor in L.A., I can tell you how many auditions I've seen coming out of MTV where they don't take anyone over 25 years old. They literally verbalize that in writing. They put it in writing, you know, no one over 25. They've basically taken something that was good and just turned it into a way to either to make money or to continue to lengthen the careers of people that they represent and have a financial stake in. You know, these snookies, these people like that, that really should go away after 15 minutes. They basically use these.
Paul, tell us about. Paul, tell us then about the scandalous world of film festivals, and has this movie pissed some people off?
It has. Well, what's funny, get back to what you were saying. I think anything, if you present an alternative to the establishment, and that alternative becomes successful, that alternative eventually does become the establishment. And the film isn't really meant to be anti-Sundance or anti-film festival. It's just meant to be a reality check. Like, we're living, filmmakers have been sort of fed this myth, which was true still only for a very small percentage of people in the early 90s, when, you know, there weren't a lot of films being made. There weren't as many as there are now because you didn't have access to digital technology. It was all 16 millimeter. So you had the fact that the, you know, Sundance Institute picked up this American film festival, bought it. And, you know, back in the early 90s, you didn't have full screenings and the industry didn't really go there. And you had little films that could get in that really were made with credit cards and love and not much else. They could get in and they could get discovered. And that became such a successful platform that now Sundance, you know, develops their own movies. They call it the Institute, but really, I mean, they're bringing in. You wonder why Sundance movies have all the same actors. Well, they're the ones going to the Institute, volunteering their time and booking five or six movies in a row that all have guaranteed acceptance into Sundance.
And how has Robert Redford allowed this? I thought the whole point was to not have things like this happen.
Well, I think, you know, what he's. Well, one, I don't know how involved he is day to day, but two, he's a movie star and has been a movie star for a very long time. So let's talk about how insulated he may be to what the common, you know, struggling artist really goes through, what that experience is to him. He's seeing young people come in that, you know, their films fit his sort of mental mission statement, and they come in and they work with established talent. They make something maybe that's different than Fox would have developed internally, but they're still making basically the same kinds of movies. But I don't think that's really a problem. The problem is that they still live off this myth. If they said, hey, we are a specialty cinema showcase and market, and we're going to be the, you know, the American Con. Con doesn't pretend to be an independent film festival. Con says we're going to bring you the finest in world cinema we can get our hands on that fits our, you know, our curated program. If Sundance said that, great, no problem. But distributors would stop going there looking to find the next Kevin Smith, because they haven't found the next Kevin. There hasn't been a breakout from Sundance like that. The last guy to come out of Park City that had made a little tiny movie that broke out and became a big thing was Chris Nolan with the movie Following, and that was a Slam Dance movie, not a Sundance movie, in 1999, I believe.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was a long time ago.
That was the last, I mean, I think maybe now Rian Johnson with, you know, his new movie Looper, he had Brick, which is a $500,000 film he made. That was, you know, 10 years ago. But that's taken him 10 years to get to this. So it doesn't really happen anymore. And that's okay, as long as, you know, as long as the business doesn't, you know, hold it against you if your little $30,000 movie didn't get into Sundance, because agents, distributors are also operating on that myth, and filmmakers are too. And if you know, hey, my little film is not going to get in, maybe I should put my energy elsewhere, and you won't suffer this crushing disappointment.
When did this corruption begin? When did the big leagues, the powers that be, infiltrate?
I think it's Well, it actually started to happen pretty quickly. Once you had those first few successes, you had, you know, Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez come out of there, and then Kevin Smith and Ed Burns.
In other words, as soon as they saw dollar signs.
Right. Slam Dance started in 1995 as an answer to Sundance, and that was when they really started to see sort of the big corporations come in and the big distributors get their hands in, and they said, hey, we want to start this festival. And Slam Dance is actually harder to get into than Sundance because they have more submissions and fewer slots. But they have criteria for what gets in. It has to be a little independent movie. It has to be a first-time director. It has to be under a certain budget cap. I mean, they put braces on what they can take so that you have to be kind of a newbie. And they don't, you know, have this institute that funnels through A-list talent. If you are a second-time director and you want to get into Slam Dance, you have to go for the special screening slots, of which there are three. And I think one's a documentary, one's a narrative, one's like a retro film. That's it. So they at least still have sort of this, I don't know, this cool mission that they're on. And, you know, like Paranormal Activity came out of Slam Dance. King of Kong came out of Slam Dance. So there are still discoveries to be had, but they're across the street at the Treasure Mountain Inn.
And how has this affected the way you operate now as a filmmaker? You've got your upcoming movie coming out, Favor. How is the distribution of Favor going to be affected by what you know now of the festivals?
Well, now distribution's a whole other ball of wax. Actually, this Jason Connell, who runs United, wanted me to do a documentary about distribution. I said, by the time I finish it, it'll be out of date.
Yeah.
It's changing so fast.
Film distribution is changing. So we got two things. One is is the festivals. The other is distribution.
Right.
And the idea is that once you score at a festival, that can lead to distribution.
Well, that's the way it used to be. Now, I think, you know, people are looking at it, especially with little movies, because now with the, you know, these little digital cameras, you can make a film for $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. It looks great. I mean, Ed Burns' last movie was a $9,000 movie?
Yeah.
So you can make very small films, and you don't need to get a giant sale. The Weinsteins wouldn't pick up your film anyway. They don't do that anymore. But there's no one picking up those little films anymore. But you don't have to get the big sale anymore. So instead of looking at festivals as a way to get distribution, look at them as distribution. Instead of taking your film out theatrically, if you play the Phoenix Film Festival, you're lucky to get into that festival. They have sold-out screenings. Every screening they do is pretty much sold out. If you're in competition, you will get three screenings. You'll have about 800 people see your movie over the course of 3 days. And then if you're a festival favorite or you win an award, you play one or two more times during the week. So you're going to have over 1,000 people see your movie. If you played theatrically in Phoenix, you would maybe have 200 people see your movie over the course of 35 shows in a week. So the festivals can be a form of distribution, and you don't have to lay out a lot of marketing costs, relatively speaking, or advertising costs. You still have to print your posters and your postcards and do all that stuff, but you don't have to have the big marketing push. You don't have to buy airtime. They're doing that for you. The festival already has an established audience. From there, you can go to DVD, Blu-ray yourself. Amazon's got their great own CreateSpace program where they'll basically create it for you on demand. It's so good that Paramount and Viacom use that for some of their lesser titles, all their Nickelodeon titles. They're all done through CreateSpace. There's no stock. They use the consumer level DVD and Blu-ray distribution replication method that Amazon offers to literally anybody who's got 70 minutes of content that's not porn.
Now, again, Paul, I've only seen the trailer for the documentary. So what's the end game? I mean, does your movie kind of in the end just throw its hands in the air and resign itself to you know, this is a situation, it sucks, but it's the way it is? Or do you have any suggestions for what, you know, what the average filmmaker can do to fight the power?
Well, it's definitely it serves a lot of purposes, and one of them is educational. It's really meant to be sort of, this is what it really is, and this is how you should approach it. My feeling was this: if you're on the festival circuit for a year, you're going to come off a lot wiser. You're going to be, I've learned so much. But of course, you've just already shot your bolt with your movie. You shot your wad. Your film's played the circuit, and you can't really play it again. It's too old. So my feeling was, if you're a first-time filmmaker going on the circuit, if you see our movie, you get the benefit of a year's worth of experience of what to do and what not to do and what to expect and what not to expect. So when you come on the circuit with your film, you're wiser. NYU added it to their film program. I don't know if you know that. It's been added to several colleges, actually. So
official rejection has been added.
Official rejection.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, I missed. I didn't get what you were saying.
It's
but now
part of the syllabus.
Part of the curriculum.
NYU's film program is that they've added to their curriculum so that if you want to, you know, they found that one professor told me I used to have 3 days on festivals and trying to cover what this was. Now I just show your movie in one, and it kind of covers everything. So it's not meant to just be a bitch fest or be the Fahrenheit 9/11 of film festivals. It's meant to, if you've been on the circuit, you're a filmmaker, it's meant to be catharsis. Oh my God, I'm not the only one who's gone through this. And we try to take you through the emotional beats, and we definitely approach it from the point of view of a filmmaker. And this is what we go through. You think your film's going to be huge, and you go out there and it doesn't do well, and you get rejected by these big boys, and you feel like crap, and you want to kill yourself, but then you pick yourself up, and you go through the circuit, and you find, you play these, where 99.999% of indie films play are these secondary and tertiary festivals, good regional festivals, where you'll get, instead of at Sundance, you're going to get, you know, a lot of people in the industry come look at your film. You're going to get distributors and producers and journalists. But if you play Dead Center or Phoenix or Fort Lauderdale or Stars Denver or San Diego, you're going to have real people see your movie. People actually, you're going to get right to your audience. People actually buy DVDs, actually go to iTunes and buy movies. And that's really what you should be looking at. So it's meant to more reframe it with reality and say, this is, film festivals aren't this, but they are this. And if you want to do them well, this is what you should do.
Paul, give us a little background on you. I want to talk about Favor. I want to hear more about that. Okay. But I want to hear more about you. Tell us how you got involved in filmmaking and what it's like for you now. You have a family. You have a beautiful wife who I understand is much more beautiful than you deserve.
Way hotter. No, it's ridiculous. Her only flaw is that she's got some weird geek fetish that I've totally taken advantage of.
Geek fetish? Well, you better look out because they got a geek show, Angry Dorks Podcast, on Monday. Don't ever bring her around here. There's a bunch of geeks.
Keep her away from that.
Well, I like the fact that his inn is what he's calling a weird geek fetish.
Yeah, no. Look,
you should call it your saving grace.
He conned her. Where'd you meet
absolutely.
Your wife?
Absolutely. What's the, huh?
Where'd you meet your wife?
You know, oddly enough, we met in high school.
Are you guys old high school sweethearts?
We're not. We didn't date in high school. We ran into each other years later, and we started dating then. But I was always too afraid to ask her out in high school. And she's like, well, you should have. I'm like, well, you were a cheerleader and brilliant and caustic, and you would have made my little, you know, adolescent mind explode in my skull. So, but no, I started dating her years later, and obviously now we're married. We have a kid. Whole high school friends, all my, you know, all the guys from the nerd table upon which we played D&D, by the way, they're all, you know, they're on Facebook now and they've reconnected with me and they're like, you're married to who? Like, they all know who she is. Like, you're married to Leslie?
See, this is
Leslie?
So,
God damn it. And like, so whenever stupid. I bitch on Facebook about anything, like I'm having a shitty day, traffic sucks, or, you know, this terrible thing happened, they're always like, fuck you, you're married to Leslie. You have no right to complain about any. You could be skinned and like Hannibal Lecter could use your skin to like cover his couch. You still have no right to complain because you're married to Leslie.
Well, you played your cards right because you were playing D&D in high school. I was getting laid in high school. And now look at me and now look at him.
You got to buy your time, pal.
But how did you get involved in filmmaking? How did it all start for you? Was it a high school ambition?
No, it was, let's see, I was two and I grabbed for the Super 8 camera. I've been interested in filmmaking since birth. It's been since I can remember what I've been fixed on. I come from a showbiz family, so that may be part of it.
But, are you at liberty to say who your family is?
I mean, well, it's funny, like my father's generation, they all were accountants and lawyers and none of them were in the business. But like you go back one generation from that, you have like James Mason was my great uncle.
Really?
You have all this like, you know, Hollywood kind of royalty.
James Mason from Salem's Lot?
James Mason from Salem's Lot. That's right.
I'm glad you were able
from
to place
verdict.
Him, Sal, because I was thinking it was a, I've been away, haven't seen you in a while. I thought it was that.
Who the hell is that?
Who the hell is that?
Who's the guy that sings, there ain't no good guy, there ain't no bad guy.
It's just you and me, and we just disagree.
Well,
I don't
him.
Know.
That's him, too. No, it's really not. No.
It's going to drive me crazy. Nick, you know who sings that?
He doesn't know. Our resident musician doesn't know. So let me ask you, though. You're multi-talented. You're a writer. You're a director. You're an editor.
Yeah.
And a producer, right?
Yeah.
So which is your favorite branch?
I'm a writer by nature. Everything else is an extension of the writing. Everything else is facilitating getting the movies I write onto the screen. So, and it's not just, I mean, I'll do anything. We're in Favor now, we're in post, and we're actually doing our sound design. And, you know, when it's a low budget film, you do as many things as you can yourself. So I'm doing all the Foley. And you know what Foley is? Foley is creating all the footsteps and body movements and shuffling and anything. So basically, if you drop out the dialogue track, there's still a complete soundtracks you can dub in Spanish or whatever.
Yes.
So we have to do all the Foley. So I'm doing this at home, and I've got – so you got to picture me like at 2 in the morning in my bathroom downstairs in my underwear like with the microphone aimed at the floor making little footsteps you know, on the tile. That's That's my life.
And what do your kids think when they walk in? Your kids walk in and see this.
Well, the kids actually help. Well, I have three kids. I have two from my previous marriage. One, my youngest is two, but my older ones are 10 and 15. So I always say kids are free crew. And my daughter's actually goes to a film high school called Champs.
Yeah. Here, hold this microphone, and Daddy's gonna do something.
Oh no, we're gonna go do Foley now. And she's like, okay, we're gonna go do pickup shots in the desert. She's like, okay, you know, and she gets school credit for it if I pull her.
She's not asking for a copy credit or meal.
No, she was a body double in the film. Like we put her in a trunk. We wrapped her in plastic. I'm not kidding.
This is in favor.
In favor. We put her in the trunk. We wrapped her in plastic, and we closed her. And we had her body double for a dead body. And the actor had to keep getting out of the trunk. And I'm like, don't hold your foot still. We got to cover it. Don't move your foot. And she's like jerking at this weird angle. So yeah, kids are free crews. They're off doing Foley with me. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, I got to say, Sal, this interview has reminded me a lot of recently. Sal and I met a guy who did a lot of punch-up writing for some of the acts on Last Comic Standing, and he gave us the real inside scoop, Chris Klauber. He gave us the inside scoop on that show, and it's a perfect example of what we're talking about, where this started as a legitimate game show, but they got tired of the restrictions imposed upon them by being a game show, so they made the decision, not overtly, they didn't announce it to the public, to become a reality show where they could, you know, they could basically... set the stage for whatever outcome they wanted to occur. You know, and in many cases, they started bringing on ringers. They started bringing comedians who were seasoned veterans and trying to build them as open micers. And the sad part about that is again, here was a legitimate conduit for, you know, kind of no name or aspiring up and coming, whatever you want to call it, talent that was co-opted, you know, all for the sake of profit. And also that the people who were already doing well can continue to do well and deny chances to the people beneath them. You know, so that sucks, man. And it sucks that the public seems to be buying into it with an insatiable appetite, you know.
It's the 1%, man.
Right.
It's the 1% keeping us down, even in the arts.
Tell us about Favor. Where can we look forward to seeing Favor? And tell us a little bit more about Favor, because I understand you have to run. You got to be back on a shoot or a set or something.
I got to go back and do more Foley in my bathroom.
He has to go back to his bathroom.
So give us a deadline. We have a mixed deadline.
His daughter's like, where the hell are you?
His daughter's like, Daddy, get over here.
I'm here in my clogs.
October 1st, I have to go back to mix.
So tell us what we can look forward to with Favor.
Well, Favor's a crime thriller, and it's the premise is very simple. The premise is based on the premise that a good friend helps you move, but a really good friend helps you move a body. That's sort of the idea. So it's these two guys, known each other for a really long time, since grade school. One's very successful, married, good job. The other one's divorced, unemployed, kind of a loser. And the successful one is... ladies man, he's good looking, so he's like, he kind of cheats around on his wife, and he's having this fling with this waitress, and they're in a motel room together, and she gets angry, she starts yelling at him, she falls and she accidentally dies, and he's got this problem if he can't just go to the cops because his whole life will come undone. So he turns to the only guy who he knows won't judge him, his oldest friend who he has really nothing in common with anymore, and a guy helps him move the body. And you know what happens is that brings up all the inequities in their relationship. The guy feels the rich guy owes him, and it can never be paid back enough, of course. And so the whole thing spirals out of control, and that's kind of what it is. It's basically, there are two actors that I absolutely think are awesome that I was able to get to work for me. One's Blaine Weaver, who's on a film called 6 Month Rule, actually, right now on iTunes. So he's the star of it. So I recommend, if you want to see who Blaine is, you check that one out. The other one's Patrick Day. And Patrick Day's been acting since he was a kid. Actually, this is funny. He was in Ernest Goes to Camp. He was one of the evil camp kids that Ernest turns around.
Well, you were able to secure these actors because they must have a geek fetish or something, right?
They do. They're great actors. And I just, honestly, like, I saw their work before I made friends with them. I saw them like, wow, this guy's really great. And then I went and, of course, you know, make friends with them. If you're a filmmaker, you're not a geeky fan, you can be, you know, on the same level and have a beer and become friends. I wrote the parts for them. And so I was able to sort of take them, and we just did this. It's very an acting intensive movie. You know, it's a way to do things on a lower budget is you have really good actors and characters and good writing as opposed to CGI latex and whatever else you were talking about before.
Well, we definitely look forward to seeing Favor. Paul's got to run out of here to go meet his kids and do some Foley. You can read some stuff that he's written in Movie Maker Magazine and FilmThreat.com. Check him out on Twitter.com/PaulMakesMovies. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Osborne. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
Thank you guys so much. It was awesome.
And we are moving on with our show. And this is... Oh, we are getting into Sal's rant next, right?
Take it away, Sal.
Well, do we have a sponsor for today's rant?
We do not have a sponsor for today's rant. Yes, we do have a sponsor for today's
race. Chris is supposed to be in charge of securing our sponsors. He is in charge of making those sales calls. You know, you got to pound those phones. You got to get those sponsors. Chris, what happened this week?
Okay, I apologize. You're absolutely right, Sal. I was lying down on the job. I got caught with my pants down, as they say. Our sponsor took her sweet time in getting me the information I needed and literally got it to me a few minutes before the show began.
Well, so, who is our sponsor for Sal's Weekly Rant?
It is Century 21 Real Estate, Century 21 Crest out of Burbank, California. In only 6 short weeks, you can begin a new career in the exciting field of real estate. For $299, you can start on your path to unlimited income potential. Century 21 Crest offers all the classes you need in order to get licensed. And after you pass the state exam, we do everything we can to assist you in realizing your income potential. Give them a call at 818-845-8322. That's 818-845-8322. Ask for Kathy Toso, rock star real estate agent and lovely lady.
Well, thank you, Kathy. Thank you for being a sponsor of our show. We really appreciate that. So here's Sal's Weekly Rant. You know, something I've been thinking about lately, you know, based on an 80-year lifespan, your average person may live to about 80 years. They spend 3 years of their lives in the bathroom. And that is 1 hour a day, 1,120 days, 24-hour periods in the bathroom. And what do we do in the bathroom? Eliminating, showering, cleaning, shaving. Feminine hygiene stuff, you know, you ladies, I don't know. We don't know what you do in there, but some feminine hygiene stuff happening. Blow our noses, brushing our teeth, flossing, hair combing, fixing, styling, or applying your hair for some of us. All maintenance of the body. If you add on also sex, some people have sex twice a week. Your average person twice a week, 10 minutes each time. These lucky bastards. Exercise 2 hours a week, which is 320 days, which is almost a year of your life. Eating 2 hours a day. 2,240 days of your life. That's over 6 years spent eating in our life. Sleeping 7 hours a day, 7,840 days over an 80-year lifetime. That's over 21 years spent sleeping. So essentially all this time in the bathroom, all this time eating, exercising, sleeping, 31 years of our lives are spent in the bathroom, having sex, eating, sleeping, or exercising. All for the maintenance of the body. One third of our lives are spent doing that. So what do people do to try to make up that time? We try to talk faster, drive faster, type faster, text faster, when essentially we just need to start moving faster in the bathroom. We need to start combining things. We need to be faster. We need to brush our teeth. I did it this morning. Brush our teeth and shave at the same time. We have two hands, most of us. Brush your teeth and shave at the same time. Brush your teeth and comb your hair at the same time. Also, you can combine doing your hair, fixing your hair, and blowing your nose while sitting on the toilet, or combining sitting on the toilet and eliminating while you are doing it at the same time. Or you can combine sex and exercise, make it sexercise. So in other words, these mundane tasks are the things that we have to be faster at. It's not that we got to be faster at work. It's not that we got to be faster on the road. We got to be faster doing these mundane tasks. So if you just think, if you save some of that time in the bathroom, if you save some of these 31 years spent on all this maintenance of the physical body, we'll be able to get some of our life back. So go faster, get out of the bathroom quicker, and have sex less often.
I'm one step ahead of you, Sal. This morning I masturbated and defecated at the same time right on the toilet and save me.
What an image. What an absolute...
I call it masturbating.
I actually enjoy texting while masturbating. It's texturbating. I've tried that as well.
The other party never has to know.
What they don't know is not going to hurt them. That was Sal's weekly rant. Basically, we need more time to do those mundane tasks.
I like that, Sal. You're kind of saying sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You don't need to get behind the wheel and cut other drivers off and go all road rage. You need to save more time in smaller ways, but ways that maybe you hadn't even considered saving time on.
That is the general point. Yes, thank you for reiterating that. Chris, I want to get into our final segment if we can.
It's the surprise segment. So yes. I've got a surprise for you. I've got a surprise for the guests.
Okay, well, what is it?
Chris's rant.
What?
Yeah, it's never been done before.
Chris's rant.
That's right.
We have a sponsor for Chris's rant.
No, I shot my sponsor. I shot my wad on you.
Well, you know what? Our sponsor is going to get a bonus because they will sponsor two rants. Chris, take it away.
Perfect. Let me open our sponsor here. We're going to use the same sponsor. She's that darn good. This first of Chris's weekly rant is again brought to you by Century 21 Crest. In only 6 short weeks, you can begin a new career in the exciting field of real estate. Century 21 Crest offers all the classes you need in order to get licensed. And after you pass the state exam, they do everything they can to assist you in realizing your income potential. They teach classes on contracts, lead generation, and closing. So give them a call today at 818-845-8322.
You really are serious. You really read that whole thing again. I was kidding.
You meant.
Go ahead, man. Take it away.
All right. Here's the deal, guys. My job interview was scheduled for 6 p.m. My 36-mile trek to Pomona took an hour 10. I arrived with 15 minutes to spare, just enough time to visit In-N-Out. I ordered one of their Peerless double-doubles and a Diet Coke. The order taker announced what I presumed was my total, but the drive-through monitor's abysmal sound quality rendered her words incomprehensible. Acting on memory alone, I drew $5 and a dime. When I pulled on at the window, the listless teens cashier rehashed my total, $6.78. My head cocked like a dumbfounded dog's. How did it get so pricey? I politely inquired. Our prices have gone up, she reflexively replied. I recited the price of my drink, $1.45, followed by the seemingly universal price of a double-double, $3.45. That totals just $5 shy. $5. Tax, she volleyed. My patience nearly spent, I explained that the local tax rate would have to be near 40% to account for such a significant markup. That's higher than L.A., New York, and Tokyo's tax rate combined. She held her vapid smile. I checked my watch. 5 minutes till showtime. Given my sudden time crunch, I handed her $7. She handed me my order plus French fries that I never ordered. Her mistake was not the kind one makes due to drowsiness or distraction. She genuinely could not see the problem, even after I'd verbalized it in several incarnations several times. No, she did not have an accent. No, she was not wearing a helmet. My interview went well enough, given the fact that my mind was occupied with dreading the inevitable day when I will, in fact, be paying a 40% tax rate to feed, educate, medicate, and incarcerate her brood of bastard offspring.
Where did this actually happen?
This actually happened in Pomona.
Pomona? You know what? I believe that our guest, Paul Osborne, is from Pomona. Yeah, he is, just by chance. And Nick Chacon just moved from Pomona, home of the L.A. County Fair.
Nick Chacon is, of course, our sound engineer and local pot dealer.
Yep, pot dealer, Pomona.
He also gives guitar lessons.
Not a pot dealer, but yeah, I'm from Pomona.
He's not a pot dealer. He just looks like one.
He's willing to share without asking for compensation. Nick takes guitar lessons. He does all kinds of cool stuff. He operates a full-service business out of his van.
We got to be winding down. Who's our guest next week? You know who we got next week? Next week we got a fitness guru and stand-up comedian and also... Van Fox. Here to promote her one-woman show called Blindsided. Her name is Jeanette Rizzi. She will be our guest here in the studio next week.
Lovely and talented Jeanette Rizzi. You know what else we have, Sal? Another edition of Sketchy Characters.
Oh, Sketchy Characters. That's right. We dug up some more of those 45s from your attic, or are they 78s? And we're going to be playing some more of those. So next week we will have another episode of Sketchy Characters.
Yeah, the first one went so well. We got a lot of flattering emails from the listeners, and they said they loved it when they wanted us to bring a few more. So I figure once every week or two should be a...
I'm all for it. Tomorrow I will be a guest on Drew Marks' show, Bad Advice, here at 1 p.m. Pacific time. Chris, do you have any shows coming up?
Yeah, I'll be co-hosting a weekly wrap-up with Kenneth Gus August on Sunday. And at the end of the month, guys, I'll be performing at the Ventura Harbor Comedy Festival, at the Ventura Harbor Comedy Club in Ventura. A couple different shows down there. So I'm looking forward to seeing you. I'll also be performing at Harris Casino in, I believe it's San Diego, California, at the end of the month. So please, if you're around anywhere, feel free to come check me out. I'd love to meet you in person.
We definitely appreciate all of you listening out there. We appreciate the support. We want to thank you for calling in when you have. And we want to thank you for tuning in next week and checking out Jeanette Rizzi. Thank you for joining us on Registered Ear Offenders. This is Sal Rodriguez and my co-host,
Chris Z.
Chris Z. Thanks.